can cut this out, so we can just start it whenever.
Hi friends, welcome back to another episode of Cults, Killers, and Cocktails with Jen and Vanessa.
Please be advised, the following episode is for mature audiences only. We talk about content that may be triggering to some individuals and contain discussions regarding rape, murder, sex, suicide, religious organizations, and disturbing situations.
Now, let's get into this week's episode.
Hi, welcome to another episode
of Cults, Killers, and Cocktails. I am your host, Vanessa.
And I'm your host, Jen.
Sorry that it's been a minute for us. It's summertime here, and we've had a lot going on.
Yep, I just went to Ukraine on a mission trip, and when I got back, I wasn't feeling super great. Everyone in the office was calling me U-Corona-19, you know, so just had to get some rest, but now we're back and at it. And then Vanessa?
I've been in the South, in Arkansas, on a lake. On a raft, so that's about it going on my part, but we're back now, and we're here to tell you a couple of great stories today.
Yeah, so actually, if you know anything about me, I'm obsessed with TikTok. I love TikTok.
I think
TikTok's amazing. It's part of my routine to lay in my bed and watch TikTok before I go to work every morning.
Kind of like a decompressant tool, I feel like.
It is. I work out, I shower, I watch TikTok for exactly 10 minutes, and then I go to work.
Oh, you work out too, though. I don't know about that.
So this was actually super popular on TikTok back in March, and I didn't see it back in March, but this is very, very recent.
Okay, I might actually know this one.
You might. Okay. So have you ever heard of The Garden?
No, dang it, I don't know this one.
I didn't either. I was like, are we not as cool as the youths?
No, we'll never be as cool as the youths. We're millennials. Okay. I turn 30 tomorrow, like.
We're still wearing skinny jeans.
Yeah, hair is parted to the side.
So, The Garden would, it actually made a bunch of waves on TikTok back in March because a lot of people are trying to figure out if it's a cult or if it's just like a happy community. So, I'll let you listen to everything and then you can tell me what you think.
Got it.
So The Garden is an intentional, off-the-grid community. They are located in Lafayette, Tennessee, and it's been around for about 12 years, which I think is honestly pretty impressive for anything to be around for 12 years.
So this wasn't like created on TikTok?
No, this is like a thing before TikTok, but then TikTok brought attention to it.
Gotcha.
It was started by this guy named Patrick Martin. He had always been involved in these types of like bohemian communities that are all about living off the grid, self-sustaining, happy-go-lucky.
Kind of like make your own, self-sufficient.
Yeah, it's like a utopia. Okay. So he actually grew up in a utopia that was associated with something called the Rainbow Gathering Movement and the Rainbow Family of Living Light. I don't know where they come up with these names, but the Rainbow Gatherings were pretty much like a bunch of loose-knit communities, people from all different walks of life that would go into remote forests around the world. And for like 1 or 2 weeks at a time, they would have the intention of like a shared living with peace, harmony, freedom, respect. So pretty much hippie vibes out in the forest.
Okay.
And The Garden was an offshoot of this. And when it was started, it was first called Shut Up and Grow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I don't know where they switched from that to The Garden. But the website back then described it as an alternative leaderless community propagating a culture of sharing freedom and cooperation. In a YouTube interview from July of 2020, so not that long ago, he explained that the clear goal of The Garden was to enable and empower as many people as possible, as fast as possible, to no longer need money. So he wanted people to live off the land and be self-sustaining. And he said he had a vision where he'd get this land, he'd put it out there on the internet, and then let people know what they were planning on doing, and people would just flock there as kind of like a safe haven.
It really doesn't sound like a bad cult. I mean, free food, you know, you don't have to have a job, I guess, if people don't want that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like cool. Kind of like a hippie thing, like you said.
Right. You're just all hanging out with people. The big thing about this is they said it was leaderless. When I think of a cult, I always think of one leader and then everyone kind of follows them.
Yeah, that stood out to me too.
Yeah, so these people, obviously they're working on the land, they're living off of the land. Every Wednesday and Sunday, they have these thing called council meetings where every single person that lives in this commune will go and they'll talk about updates. If someone wants to do a project, they'll get it approved to do the project. And everyone has equal say with how everything's being run.
So do they just have it approved through everybody else? Like, if everybody else says it's okay since it's leaderless?
So, yeah, or? Funny you say that. They have a 10-second rule. And the 10-second rule, yeah. So if you want to do a project, you will speak your piece about whatever you want done, or if you want an update, or you want something to be ran different. And then after you're done with your little spiel, there's 10 seconds. And everyone will hold up both hands, and they'll start the countdown for 10 seconds. So if anyone has, you know, anything to say against it as a rebuttal, or they're not comfortable with it, then they can speak and, you know, we can start the conversation then.
Speak now and forever hold your peace.
Yeah.
Basically.
And if no one objects, then you just move forward.
I'm going to do that at my future wedding.
I know, right? 10 seconds for objections. Everyone hold up your hands. But yeah, so if anyone would contest an update that's going on, then they don't do it. Everything has to be 100% agreed upon.
Okay, so that makes sense.
So huge community mentality. Mm-hmm. They have an open door policy as far as who they let in, which is kind of scary and
a little bit
different. So
no background checks or nothing?
No.
And wow.
Some of these, there's other communities like The Garden, but to even get there just to go have a visit, you have to email them. You have to have a background check. Like, it's a very vigorous process because they don't want anyone going in there. And The Garden's special because literally anyone can just come. It's an open door policy.
Huh.
They'll ask people to leave if needed, but when you show up, you have 10 days. 10 days where, like, you know, you can see how everyone lives, and then you decide if you want to ask to stay there, if you want to ask just to be there for a couple months, a couple weeks. But if anyone, again, is like, no, I do not feel comfortable with, you know, her being involved in this group, then you're kicked out.
They're very obsessed with the number 10.
Yeah.
They like the number 10.
And a lot of issues online, they had issues with people with, like, mental health issues coming in there, or people just trying to find a place to stay and kind of using them. But then they said that because they have the system where if anyone feels uncomfortable, they were just easily able to kick them out.
Okay.
So it's a lot of people coming and going. A lot of them during interviews said they don't really fit in mainstream society, so they felt this was like a safe place.
Okay.
That's pretty much like a basic idea of what the community is, what they stand for. And this is pre-TikTok.
Oh, okay.
So, like, in my mind, it's just a bunch of nice people that just want to live away from everybody. So then I was curious why it was such a big issue, and it was because of the internet.
The internet. Right. Causes problems for everyone.
So it all started with this guy named Tree. And Tree. That's not his real name, it's what his, you know, what he goes by.
What his garden name is.
Right, yeah. He started making TikToks about his lifestyle. The kid's, like, in his early 20s, so he's just a typical kid.
Okay.
But usually it would get like 6,000 likes, you know, for a video, which is still good, but not, you know, anything to go viral. But it'd be like, this is a compost toilet, and here's someone painting, and, you know, we're all happy, and we did a bonfire today,
yeah.
And life is so good on this compound.
Yeah, come join us in the garden.
Yeah, so then in February 2021, he posted a video with a whole tour of the garden, and put the address on there and was encouraging everybody to come check it out.
Oh, no.
See how we live. See if you want to do this. Because he was trying to get their vision out there. And it blew up. It went crazy. He went from having like 6,000 followers one night to waking up to having 82,000 the next day.
That's crazy that with that video it blows up. But with all the others, it doesn't?
Well, apparently their algorithm for some reason got messed up where it was going on like everyone's for you page or something like that.
You got a hashtag FYP.
Yeah. So it went insane. So he got all these followers and everyone was really, really focusing on this compound. He would keep posting these TikToks. Of course, people on TikTok like to investigate things and they like to get a little crazy sometimes. So they started finding all these members in like the real world and running background checks on them and seeing like what type of people are flocking to these communes.
Wow.
Yeah. So they found some people that were, you know, like criminals, which everyone has a past. I'm not saying people can't change, but if you don't know someone has a criminal background and you're living right next to them and sharing a tent, you know, it could be weird, you know? Yeah. And people call child services because, again, what if there's a pedophile there and nobody knows because there's no background check being done?
That's what I'm saying. Like, there's a difference between, like, having a weed charge and having a molestation charge.
I agree. So, yeah, Tree's TikToks were, again, very, very light, just showing how happy they are, how everyone's living together in harmony. And then there was another member of this group.
Oh, no.
Her name was Rel Gumson.
Rel Gumpson.
Yeah.
Sounds like Rumpelstiltskin.
And she actually thrived off the negative attention, because around this time, some people were like, you guys seem really happy. This is awesome. It's great. Other people were like, is it a cult? You know, are people being held here against their will? What's their ideologies? And just very looking into it. And once the cult accusations came out, Rel decided to start getting on her TikTok too and posting videos. But her videos weren't like Tree. So they would mock people by posting cult-like things. For example, she had one where they labeled a huge jug called Kool-Aid, and she would have everyone like, time to drink the Kool-Aid, and she'd walk around there and make everyone drink the jug. So that's not helpful when people are calling you a cult and you're literally just rubbing it in their faces. Like, she thought it was funny. Like, TikTok did not think it was very funny.
Yeah, they're gonna blow her up. Yeah. And the thing is, all these people that she was giving the Kool-Aid to, like, were they wanting to do it? Were they, like, wanting to lead into the hate, I guess, or the haters?
I think they just thought it was a funny joke. You know, they thought it wasn't that big of a deal.
Okay, so they didn't think it was going to be perceived.
No.
So negatively. Got it.
And when people asked her about it, she said she wasn't referring to Jonestown, which, of course, we know from an earlier episode is where the Drink the Kool-Aid thing comes from, with the Flavor-Aid, where they killed most of their members.
Yeah, no, that's not cute.
But she said it was actually Ken Casey's LSD-laced Kool-Aid, which was in this acid test, which nobody even really knows about that. And I'm like, you know that if you did that, people would think Jonestown.
Yeah. That's what you were going for. Don't lie, baby.
Yeah. Things kept getting worse and worse and worse. Tree was started doing live streams, which a lot of people do live streams. I've never really been into them, but apparently there were a bunch of people watching on this particular live stream. And in the video, he talked about how the members had killed a cat. And if you want the internet to hate you,
kill a cat.
I mean, what's that Netflix show?
Don't Fuck with Cats?
Yeah.
With Luca Magnotta?
Yep.
Yeah, fuck him.
Yeah. So this obviously didn't go over well. It was a way to make even more hate go towards this group. And he eventually told the backstory. So they have chickens. They all have their own livestock that they live off of.
They have eggs.
Yeah. And apparently there was a feral cat that was coming in and attacking the chickens and the eggs and everything. So they made a trap and then they had to kill the cat to protect the chickens.
You don't have to kill it.
This is from their side. So they said they had to kill the cat to protect the chickens. And then they're one of those people that everything has to be used. Right?
Yeah, so nothing goes to waste.
They killed the cat, and then they ate the cat.
Okay, yep, no.
And then this girl that we talked about earlier that was posting the weird videos actually made it into a hat.
The cat?
Mm-hmm.
How did she make it into a hat?
She skinned it.
That's disgusting.
She didn't want anything to go to waste.
That's disgusting.
And in other interviews, she had a dog that was hit by a car, and she skinned it and used its skin, too, to make a skirt.
Okay, that's disgusting as well, but that's not as bad because that was hit by a car.
Yeah.
You killed this because it was hungry and trying to eat chickens or whatever because it was a poor little kitty.
Yeah. So, everyone's starting to hate them.
Good, I hate them too. Let's get our pitchforks ready.
And people kept, you know, digging into it, and they showed on maps. The garden was really, really close, and again, this is in Tennessee. It's really, really close to a couple historical sundown towns. Do you know what a sundown town is?
I have no idea.
So this is back in the Jim Crow era that people of color were not allowed to live there, and they couldn't go there after dark.
Oh, that's...
Or they'd be attacked.
That's not good.
So they know that they're close to these towns. And again, so people are trying to say, like, you guys are probably racist, too.
Oh, gotcha.
The garden is not racist. I was watching all these videos, documentaries, of course, TikTok. They are open to everybody. I will say that from watching everything. Okay. They have people of all different races living there.
Okay.
It didn't seem like that'd be anything that they would exclude.
All right.
So, again, after they blew up on TikTok, they had animal control out there.
Good.
Because people were calling animal control. And they also had child protective agencies go out there. Because, again, all these people from around the world are calling to be like, you need to go check out this place. Make sure it's safe for the kids.
Yeah.
Because there are kids that do live there. Also, USCIS, Immigration Services... Because Tree's actually from the UK. So people are like, he's abusing his visa by going out here and, like, living in just the wild.
So they were just trying to get them on anything that they could.
Yeah. And, again, all these agencies came out there and they're like, it's weird, but, like, they're not doing anything wrong. They're not breaking any laws. You know, if the cat really was doing that, they can't get in trouble for it. And, again, this is a community where people come and go. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the people that even actually killed the animal, they didn't live there anymore. So what are you supposed to do?
Right. Charge them.
Yeah.
Animal cruelty.
And the group-like mentality is what people said made it a cult, especially on TikTok or Cult Talk, which is apparently a thing on TikTok that I was just introduced to.
Did you follow them?
I did.
Good.
Yeah, it's amazing. But yeah, so they were saying, we know there's no leader. We know it's not tied to a religious organization or anything. But because they have this group mentality, you know, that makes it a cult. People that had actually flocked to this group had said that they were lonely with their city life. And they just wanted to join a community that had involvement with friends, which I think we saw in the pandemic. A lot of people felt that way. But then not only did people on TikTok actually call to send these agencies out there, they started giving death threats to this group. And again, they'd already posted their address online. It was common knowledge where they are. People said that they were going to come over there and burn all of their huts down. They were going to murder, like, Tree got specific death threats against him, so he ended up actually having to leave the commune. Him and his partner did.
Wow.
Yeah, so now they're actually out in Colorado, and they're running educational workshops to talk about sustainability and the danger our planet's in if we don't take care of it.
Tree, are you listening? Don't give out your address this time.
And Rel left the garden because they wanted her to quit posting all of these, like, controversial TikToks. And she was like, no, I want to do my own thing. So then they had to ask her to leave.
10 seconds, 9 seconds.
Right, yeah. I wonder how many seconds they got to before they kicked her out.
I feel like that was like a minute, a good 60.
Yeah, and when Tree and his partner, they were just interviewed about what it was like when they left, they said they were down to 4 people. Around this whole TikTok craziness, it was at 40 people.
Wow.
So to go from 40 people to 4 is crazy. So they've now closed their doors to the public because they can't trust anyone because of all the death threats. So it's just those 4 people that are living there, at least for now, and they're thinking it might actually not be a thing in the near future.
I mean, don't fuck with cats. Honestly, like, did you not watch the Netflix series? Clearly not.
And if so, do not go on the internet and talk about it. But yeah, so do you think it's a cult or is it just a commune?
Oh God, I forgot about this pop quiz at the end. I feel like it can go 50-50, honestly.
I think so, too. Because when you're doing group mentality and you're not thinking with yourself, you're thinking for a group.
There's no leader.
Yeah.
That's, like, the big thing of a cult.
But you can leave on your own accord. So, like, you know, other cults, you weren't allowed to leave. At this one, you could leave on your own time.
Yeah. I feel like it was just more so, like, people wanting to make friends and wanting a break from life.
I think so, too.
And then just kind of going out there and trying to, you know, be hippies. Be modern-day hippies in Tennessee. But they screwed up. And they, you know, posted animal abuse, which I say, screw them for doing that.
Right.
So, I think it's more of a commune, though.
Yeah, I agree.
You agree?
Yeah, that's the garden.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
That was really good.
It's just different, but
yeah. I really like that. Good job.
Yay.
Snaps for you.
So, what do we have for the cocktail this week?
So, this is called a desert sunset. And basically, what you're going to do is you're going to get like a rocks glass and put some salt and smoked paprika, not normal paprika, smoked, because that makes the difference. You're going to pour 2 ounces of silver tequila in a shaker, and you're going to pour 1/2 ounce of agave syrup, 1 ounce of fresh carrot juice, and 1/2 ounce of fresh orange juice. You shake that all up, pour it in the glass, and you know, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty good.
If you like carrot juice, you'll love it.
If you are a really big fan of carrots, you will like this cocktail. But the smoked paprika gives it like a smoked aftertaste, I guess. But yeah, so that is our cocktail of the week, and we will post that on our Instagram. All right, are you ready for my story?
I'm so ready.
Okay, guys. So first I want to say we paused the podcast for a little bit, and we looked at Tree's TikTok. And you guys should totally do that right now because it's interesting.
He's at Tree is Alive.
Yes. And he was actually live at the moment we looked at it. So, this is a little bit of a long one. So, buckle up for this. But I feel like it needs to be told. So, in March of 2005, the mother of 26-year-old Victoria Chavez was walking into a police station to do one of parents' worst nightmares. She was going to report her child as missing. Although, you know, she's technically not a child, rather a grown woman, she was still her baby that she hadn't seen in over a year.
And she's just now reporting her missing?
Mm-hmm. No, her nor her family had heard a peep from her. See, Victoria was the mother of two little children of her own, who had fallen into the dark and deep path of sex work and drug use. She had been charged 5 times for these crimes, according to court records. She especially had a hard time of staying out of jail due to a probation officer that struggled to keep her on a straight and narrow path. It wasn't uncommon not to hear from her. So that's like why it was an entire year. But you know, after X amount of months, your loved ones are going to get concerned. So as I said, her mother finally made the leap and filed the report. And that report would stay filed for the next 4 years.
Wow.
On February 2nd, 2009, Christina Ross was walking her dog Ruka, a brown Shar Pei mix, and she let her off the leash to just kind of explore for a little bit. Ruka was sniffing something and just wouldn't quit. You know how dogs get, like when they're on a scent. Rather than being like, quit sniffing, we gotta walk to walk, she let her continue and then eventually was curious to see what the heck she was sniffing. She approaches Ruka, and it looks like she's sniffing some kind of animal bone. I mean, this is the desert of New Mexico. It's not crazy to find animal bones like that out here. But this one was pretty big, almost too big to be any kind of animal around these parts of Albuquerque. She calls her sister, who is a registered nurse. She was like, sis, this doesn't look like a squirrel bone. Can I take a picture and send it to you? Once her sister got the picture, she was like, yeah, that's definitely a human femur.
That's quite a big bone, sure.
Yeah, she was like, you need to call the police like yesterday. Fun fact, Christina has actually moved out of Albuquerque and lives in Arizona, which I don't blame her at all. Although if I were her, I'd probably move to like Canada or something to get away from the deserts. So the human femur belonged to Victoria Chavez. The thing was, though, this wouldn't be the only femur that they would find. In the coming weeks, they are going to find a total of 11 sets of adult women femurs, along with a pair of unborn baby femurs.
Oh my gosh.
I think I said femurs. Femurs. As I said, Victoria was found on February 2nd, 2009. The final set of bones was found on February 25th, 2009.
Oh my goodness.
So if you're unfamiliar with this case, do you have a guess as to what it is?
No.
I briefly mentioned it in our last episode, but decided I'm impatient and I want to find out about this now. So this is the story of the West Mesa murders. Have you heard of this?
I don't know. It sounds familiar, but I don't know if I have or not.
Girl, buckle up. So if you are unfamiliar with this case or don't live in Albuquerque in general, the Mesa is a flat landscape in the desert. There's not a lot of vegetation, but there's like a lot of dried up shrubs, just like as any typical desert. So since it's the West Mesa murders, it's literally found on the west side of the desert.
Makes sense,
but I didn't put that together when I was first reading about this case. This particular area of the West Mesa started turning into a suburban area surrounded with new homes from the housing boom in the 2000s. And it wasn't a bad area at all. I mean, the subdivisions surrounding this blank spot of land had names like Anderson Heights, Arrowwood Hills, Sungate Estates, so it was pretty, like, up-and-coming, I guess you could say. So this gravesite that Christina was walking in the first place was at the corner of 118th Street and Amoli Mesa Avenue. So since it's only 2009, it's still kind of like a relatively new area, and Christina had just moved to the area. Which, can you imagine finding a femur in the backyard?
Okay, because I'm like, if you used it as a dumping ground back then, what's to say you won't come back and use that same area again?
Exactly. The only reason that this particular gravesite was still bare was because of the recession, aka the housing market collapse in 2008 and 2009.
Remember that?
Yeah. Remember when gas was $4 per gallon?
Right.
That's like when I first started driving. Gas was $4.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I can't afford this. So although the area of land was big, all the bodies were found in a 90-foot long by 30-foot wide area in shallow graves that were only 8 to 10 inches deep.
That's it.
They clearly weren't spread out at all. There were no personal belongings or clothing found with the victims. And apparently the area is pitch black at night since it wasn't developed yet.
Makes sense.
They think that's how the killer was getting away with everything. This uncovering of bodies lasted for weeks. The city of Albuquerque literally had excavators, which are like those big machines with a big scooper on it, just looking for human remains. But they had to be careful because this was potential evidence. And even more importantly, this is one time a human. They had to be careful for identification purposes.
Right.
Only bones were found. According to the trusty search engine Google, it takes 3 weeks for a body to completely decompose, but it could be shorter or longer due to environmental factors. So like rain, heat.
I'm sure the desert makes it go so much faster too.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. Like heat would speed everything up. How they were picking the location to look for the bodies is that they were looking at the depressions in the ground from satellite images.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so they were looking at some of these and there were no bodies found in these graves, so they think that they were like pre-dug and the victims never made it to the graves.
That's ridiculous.
And that's creepy and eerie. The killer never got to these, but I say killer as an anonymous because this case is unsolved.
Great.
Yeah, great. To this day, July 11th, 2021, this is the biggest quote-unquote current case in all of New Mexico history, and honestly, I would guess the United States.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go into all the victims that were discovered in this puny 90 by 30 square foot area. And honestly, I'm taking this approach because I feel like sometimes, but not all the time, as true crime fanatics, we hear these cases and we think, God, that's awful. Well, let's listen to the next case. Let's click the next episode. But these are real people who had real lives. Every victim is important. Everyone had a purpose. Every victim had a life. And any of the victims could have been you or me, your mom, your sister, your aunt, or your best friend. Anyone in the wrong place at the wrong time. In this situation, you'll see pretty quickly that the victims were addicted to prostitution and drugs. Mm-hmm. Which, gross, don't ever blame the victim. We're not blaming the victim here. But I just say that because these victims probably wouldn't have ran away from some creep coming up to them as you or I would have.
Right.
Because this is what they did as a living. The victims have been linked to a stretch of legendary Route 66, known as East Central Avenue, where it passes through in Albuquerque. Apparently, this roadway is lined with sketchy motels and fast food joints, and known for acts taking place in cars and rooms for rent. So, sex acts. So, we already know the first victim, aka the femur discovered, Victoria Chavez. Unfortunately, the information I said earlier was about all I could find. And I went into, like, the 10th page Google search.
To try to find anything.
Yeah, and I just think that since she's kind of the one that discovered everything, her family wants to keep private.
And I don't blame them.
I totally get that. Like, that's fine. The second victim was 22-year-old Michelle Valdez. She was identified by dental records. Michelle was raised by a wonderful, loving family. When she was young, I mean like high school young, she became pregnant with her first child. Which, to anyone who had a child in high school or even their late teens, early 20s, kudos to you. Because right. I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
There's no way. I'm still not ready for a child. Her parents were still supportive and loved her, but unfortunately, she fell into the wrong crowd, and they knew this. They would see Michelle, and then for a few days, they wouldn't. This stayed consistent for a while. Then the lengths of times got longer that they wouldn't see her, and they kept increasing little by little every time. And her dad actually had a calendar that he would keep track of her coming back. And he would mark it with X's. And then when Michelle would come back, he would put an O on the day that she would come back. And then they just kept getting longer and longer and longer.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah. But I think their safety net is that she would always come back to the family to ask for cash. And they would give it to her. And they knew that she spent it on drugs. And I guess that's not the best thing to do. But at the same time, they knew that she was okay.
Right. They just wanted to see her.
Yeah, if she was coming back. So the last time she saw her dad, she walked up to him and put her arms around him. And she's, quote, saying, "No, Dad, hug me hard and tight." That's what her dad said. And he said it seemed as if she knew that something was going to happen.
Yeah.
She was reported missing in February 2005. As the years wore on and this case remained unsolved, her dad became the spokesperson for the family, but he fell ill from cancer and liver problems in 2014 and died in 2015. So, I mean, that gave him, like, a little bit of closure, like, knowing that she was gone, but he still never got the closure.
Of who did this, yeah.
We still don't have it, you know? So, remember how I said there was a fetus? This was Michelle's. She was 4 months pregnant when the body was discovered, and it was also noted that Michelle was buried in a plastic bag.
I wonder if she knew she was pregnant.
I don't know. I don't know when you find out, I guess. But the third victim was 32-year-old Cinnamon Elks. Cinnamon disappeared in the summer of 2004. Her mom knew that something really bad had happened to her when she didn't hear from her on her birthday in August. Cinnamon always called or stopped by, and this was not like her. She was also the mother of two, and she would not just up and leave her kids. Her mom is quoted saying that Cinnamon unfortunately sank into the abyss of addiction. She had 19 prostitution charges with 14 convictions.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. And, I mean, I'm guessing this was her way to pay for drugs. I'm not quite sure. But she was actually friends with Michelle and Victoria. And she was also friends with another victim. Victim number four, Julie Nieto. So she was 24 years old, Julie Nieto. She disappeared on July 15th, 2004. And all of her reports describe Julie as tiny. And I mean, her mom said that when she started kindergarten, she was wearing toddler's clothing.
Wow.
So she was a tiny, tiny person. And she carried that physique into adulthood. And so I'm thinking, like, if some guy or even, like, a woman, like, came up and attacked her,
she would have be able to, no.
No chance of finding her off unless she had, like, a weapon, you know? So she went to the Job Corps after high school, which I'm pretty sure is just like a technical school, like to learn a certain trade, like welding or something like that. But the only way that she was identified was through the Job Corps' dental records because she had nothing done before that. So thank God
she
went to
it.
Yeah. After the Job Corps, she had a son and this little guy was her world. Her mom is quoted saying, quote, she was a great mother. She wouldn't let that boy go for nothing. He cried and cried for her after she disappeared, which just take my heart and rip it out.
Right.
After the Job Corps, though, nothing really worked out, but she wanted to provide a nice life for her son. And she did a job that she knew would be quick cash. She fell into the life of prostitution. She was charged and convicted with prostitution four times. Her mother desperately tried to get her out of that lifestyle, but unfortunately, it provided no avail. So she was last seen at her grandpa's house where she usually stayed. Her grandpa actually had surgery one morning. Julie's mom took him to the hospital, and when they came back, she wasn't there, but her son was. She just left him alone. That's when Julie's mom knew that she was gone. And like I said, that boy was her world. She would never have done that. Apparently, Julie and her family had relatives in jail, and a rumor actually started spreading saying they killed her. Like, quote, they killed her.
Interesting.
But no one knew who they were.
Yeah.
And this was just a rumor. Police couldn't act on a jail rumor, you know? So 2 years after Julie went missing, her sister Valerie was found dead in a motel on Central Avenue after overdosing. Her mom said it was because she was depressed and crying all the time over her sister. Then Julie was discovered not long after. So her sister never got the closure to know that her sister was dead. But in some way, you know, they already knew.
Right.
And the mom was expecting it. She knew. She was happy to have closure, whether she's alive or dead. She's still wanting closure to who did this to this day. And, I mean, if you think about it from the mom's point of view, it's kind of heartbreaking because she had to bury two daughters within, like, a few months of each other.
I can't even imagine.
No. Mm-mm. The fifth victim was Monica Candelaria, and she was 22 years old. She had been convicted of prostitution once and was known to have many gang ties, and there's really not too much information on the internet about her as well, unfortunately. We know that she disappeared in 2003, and her family got a tip that she was buried in the West Mesa. They apparently searched for weeks, but the mesa is so broad that they weren't able to find anything. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack.
I wonder where they got the tip from, too.
I know. I was wondering that, too. Like, how do you have a tip that you're buried in the West Mesa, you know? On her obituary, though, it stated that, quote, Monica enjoyed laughing, joking, taking care of babies, spending time with her family. She will be remembered as a loving daughter, mother, granddaughter, niece, cousin, and friend who will truly be missed. The sixth victim was named Veronica Romero. She was 28 years old. Veronica was an only child growing up, but she had a large extended family and a group of friends that she considered her soul sisters, which I think is kind of cute. When she disappeared in February 2004, she had 5 children of her own.
Dang!
I know. She wasn't wasting no time, baby.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Witnesses say that Veronica got into a white pickup truck, and that was the last time that they had ever seen her. Like I said, she had a huge extended family, so everyone was looking out for her. With no luck, when her body was discovered, one of her cousins spoke to the press, and they said, they haven't done nothing in all these years. And basically, what I get from this is that they're all prostitutes. So with researching this podcast, like, I feel like police have kind of like a negative view towards prostitutes and sex workers.
I'm sure, yeah.
Like discovering them, because they just think they're going to turn up. So, in fact, during this time frame, Albuquerque had more than several missing women. They had actually, like, in the upper 20s, to be exact.
Wow.
Yeah, just during the short time frame. Families were showing up to press conferences to see if their loved ones were found or not. And one family member was Teresa Fresquez, and she was the mom of Nina Heron, missing in 2005 when she was 21. She has still never been found to this day. Like, because they just want closure, you know?
Yeah, that's all I would want.
Right. Another thing, they still have not released how these victims were killed. Although suspected that they were killed by strangulation, homicidal violence is like the only thing that they're saying.
Is there a way to really tell if all you have are bones?
So, I mean, with strangulation, your hyoid bone in your neck is going to be messed up, and that's how they tell, like, during the autopsy, I guess.
That makes sense.
Yeah, but they have not released it to this day, which I'm not quite sure why, because that would give a definite pattern of killing. But Thomas Grover, he was a member of the Albuquerque Police Department at the time. He's a lawyer now. And he didn't serve on the case, but he gave an interview at the time and basically said that the police was a hot mess express. They were like oil and vinegar. There was no leadership. And they kind of just said, oh, there are a lot of bad people out there. We can't just focus on this one case.
Wow.
And
I get that. They do have other cases, but...
But when 11 bodies and a fetus are discovered in a 90 by 30 square foot area, it's probably pretty important.
Right.
You know? So, basically, he said it was, like, a thorn in their side. That's how he described it. So, the seventh victim was Doreen Marquez. She was 27 years old. Unlike the other victims, Doreen had zero prostitution arrest, but it was known that she was, in fact, prostituting. She was just never caught. She was the type of popular girl in high school that was kind of rare because she was loved by everybody. You know how...
That's super rare.
Exactly. You know how popular girls can be mean. But she was beautiful, she was a cheerleader, and she was just a joy to be around. She ended up having two baby girls in her early 20s. She was a great mom, but she had some hardships down the road. Her baby daddy, or her current boyfriend at the time, I'm not quite sure, got put away in jail. And to cope with this, she turned to drugs. And this happened, like, she became addicted to drugs only a year before she went missing. It's not like she was, like, a druggie in high school and then that just carried on. It was literally the past year. And she was actually living with her sister for a while, and her sister found a syringe in the house. And her sister basically told her, quote, you know, it's better if you just go. Whenever you feel like you're not going to use, or whenever you want somewhere to come back and eat or shower or whatever, my door is open.
But just don't do drugs in my house type deal.
Basically, don't leave syringes in my bathroom. And she never came back. So that was the last thing she ever got to say to her. She was reported missing in October of 2003. Going back to the police, not seeming to care about sex workers, her sister actually investigated this case herself because she felt like police weren't doing anything. Like, she would walk around, like, the sketchy motels. She would talk to people saying, have you seen her? And there was just no interest in this case at all.
That's so sad.
Right. When her sister visited the gravesite, she felt Doreen's hand come out of the ground and grab her, saying, like, I'm here, don't leave me.
Is she a psychic?
I don't know. Maybe she has, like, because you know how some people, like, have stronger connections with mm-hmm. that? So she might be. I don't know. It took 6 years to find her after she was reported missing in October of 2003. Her sister said that the case only got attention because the dog found the bone.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And her sister is quoted saying, it's real, I can't believe it's real. I felt relieved because she was missing for 6 years before it even happened. Message to my sister, I am sorry, I love you, this is not the way it's supposed to be. The eighth victim, I know this is a lot to handle, so.
No, this is good though.
It's a lot to handle, I know. The eighth victim was 15-year-old Solania Edwards. She was 15. Obviously, she's already different from the other victims because she was so young, but she was also the only black victim. All the other victims were Hispanic or white. She's also different that she wasn't from Albuquerque. Rather, she was a runaway from Oklahoma. She ran away from home on August 17th, 2003. She was a known traveling prostitute along I-40. Police believe that she traveled in a group of minor prostitutes, which...
I didn't even know that was a thing.
I didn't either. Like, I can't even imagine that. So at first, they didn't know who this was, because again, she wasn't from Albuquerque. And police took an interesting approach to try to identify her. They released a photograph of her acrylic fingernail.
How is that supposed to help?
Because it had a unique design on it. And so they're like, hey, if anybody's done this design, then contact the police.
Weird.
Which...
did it work?
No, because it's complete BS. Because nail salons do the same ideas all the time. Like, if you go into the salon and you're just like, hey, give me a pretty design, they'll do the same design over and over again for people. Like, it's not significant. So, like I said, it didn't work out. She ended up being identified through dental records, and I'm not sure why they didn't try this first. It might have been, like, a cross between, like, Oklahoma and Arizona.
Yeah, maybe they were waiting for her records or something.
Something like that. But imagine getting, like, the phone call as a parent and, like, the next state over. Like, your child is missing, and the next state over gives a call and says, hey, your daughter was a victim, and she was 15 years old.
And buried in a shallow grave.
8 to 10 inches. Like, it's insane. The ninth victim was Virginia Cloven, who was 24 years old. She grew up in a small trailer, and honestly, this girl had a great childhood until one event happened, and then her life basically turned into a series of unfortunate events. One day, her brother was shot and killed, and she was traumatized by this. Her and her brother were super close, and she didn't know how to cope with the pain. She ended up running away from home a week later and moved in with her grandpa.
Okay.
And then as she got older, she met a guy who became her boyfriend, and then she ended up moving in with him. Her boyfriend ends up getting hit by a car.
Oh my gosh.
That's what I'm saying, like a series of unfortunate events. He goes into a coma, and I'm pretty sure he ended up dying, but like even if he didn't, he's going to need special care for the rest of his life. He's not going to be able to quote-unquote take care of her.
Right.
So she ended up living on the streets afterwards. And I'm not sure if they were on awkward terms, but she wanted to get right with her family again.
I would too.
Right. So she calls her dad one day and she's like, listen, I know it's been a long time since we've talked, but I want to meet you for your birthday and celebrate with you. Let's meet at Grandpa's. So her dad's excited. He hasn't seen her in a long time and he agrees. And on his birthday, he drives over to her grandpa, his dad's house. And it was great until Virginia never showed up. So it was awkward between all of them, but they knew that she wouldn't make plans and just not show up.
Right. Especially after all this time.
Exactly. Like, you're the one that reached out in the first place. Like, why would you just not show up? They didn't hear from her for months and months afterwards. Finally, they reported her missing in October of 2004, 4 months later after this incident. Her dad actually searched high and low for her. The same thing as Doreen's sister. They taped pictures on the side of their truck. They drove to the sketchier parts of the city, like everything like that. Now, years later, his daughter's death still haunts him. He doesn't celebrate holidays anymore and sleeps in the living room instead of bedrooms where his kids used to stay.
Wow.
He said, quote, when you lose a kid, it's the hardest thing in the world, I think. I've lost other family members, but when it's your daughter or son, it hurts worse. The 10th and 11th victims were 27-year-old Evelyn Salazar and 15-year-old Jamie Barella. And the only reason that I'm grouping the last two together is because they were cousins.
Really?
And they disappeared at the same time.
Were they together? Did they work together?
No, they were leaving a family picnic.
Oh, wow.
Right. So their bodies were found 20 feet from the second victim, where Michelle was found. And Jamie was the only victim with no prior arrest record. So they left this picnic to go to Wilson Park. And they're theorizing that they went to score some drugs. Which I'm like, 27 years old, you're taking your 15-year-old cousin.
Yeah, there's no way.
Maybe they had, like, that kind of relationship, but I know with my 15-year-old cousin, I'd be like, get away from my beer, right. You know? But their mom said that that park is notorious for needles, broken bottles, all kind of trash left on the ground. Mutilation trigger warning. The mother of Jamie and Barilla said that the investigator told them that one of Jamie's left breasts were cut off, or Jamie's left breast was cut off. Which is interesting, because I'm like, I thought it was only bones.
That's what I was about to say. I thought it was only... how do you know that?
I don't know. I don't know how you would know that. But I don't know if there's a way to tell I'm not a scientist.
Right.
So, but now we're going to dig into the shitty pieces of wet lettuce that committed these heinous murders, which I just love calling people wet lettuce. It's so great. So first, let's talk about what got my brain thinking of this case in the first place, Scott Lee Kimball.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't listened to episode 12...
go back and listen to it.
Go back and listen to it. But he's a scumbag. And as a summary, he killed four people in Colorado. He was arrested in 2006 when all these murders seemed to stop. And if you're bad at geography, as myself, Colorado is right above New Mexico. Scott has confessed to killing more random people in prison, but he denies being involved in the West Mesa murders. Another suspect is Lou Fred Reynolds, who was 60 years old, and police said he was a pimp. He died of natural causes on January 2nd, 2009. Police found pictures of several West Mesa victims at his home, but no physical evidence.
And he could have just been, you know...
they were sex workers.
Yeah.
Could have had sex with them. Reynolds of Albuquerque was arrested in 2001 and 1998 on suspicion of promoting prostitution. So, like I said, he was a pimp. And I think they were just going off those pictures, and I don't personally think he's a very strong suspect, but unless they're withholding more information,
right?
Not quite sure. The third suspect is named Robert Howard Bruce, who is 51 years old. He is nicknamed the Ether Man, which I have no idea what ether means. Do you know what ether is?
I have no idea. So it's either a pleasant smelling colorless liquid that is highly flammable, or it's the clear sky.
Okay, well, I don't know how that would work. I don't know how he got that nickname. But he was sentenced in 2013 to 177 years in prison.
Found it.
Oh, what is it?
So apparently ether can be used to disable female, like not female, ether can be used to disable victims. Like, you know, like chloroform when you like go over someone's face.
That makes total sense, because that's how he would get his victims.
The woman who discovered her husband of 6 years was a serial rapist, yeah, said he used that.
So that's what he did, yeah, because he used chloroform and stun guns to incapacitate his victims. So, like I said, he was sentenced to 177 years in prison in 2013. So, there are five suspects that are being most eyed, and those were three of them. But these next two are, like, the primetime suspects. The first primetime suspect is Lorenzo Montoya. He was born in 1967 in Albuquerque, so he was born and raised. If my math is correct, he was around 36 when these disappearances started happening. He worked at Starline Printing as a printing pressman, which would publish the daily newspaper. Police looked into Lorenzo's past. They looked at him real hard because he had several crimes with prostitutes in that time frame in that area.
Okay.
His first prostitution-related arrest was in 1998 when he picked up an undercover detective posing as a prostitute, which I feel like that would be the scariest thing to do as a cop.
Oh, I agree. Like, hey, you're going to go out here and have weird guys pick you up.
Right.
Thank you.
Like, I know you have backup, but still, that's scary. He offered her $40. She took him to a motel room, and they arrested him. And that apparently didn't, like, faze him at all, because he was caught again with another and offered to pay her
$15.
$15? I said hashtag big money.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely not. In 1999, police watched him pick up a prostitute near Central and San Mateo and followed him to a dark dead-end road at the end of the airport, like, okay, kind of towards it. Police believe that they caught him in the act as he was trying to rape and strangle her, because he only had $2 in his pocket, and he never intended to pay her.
Right.
So he got arrested, but the case was later dismissed.
Why? She didn't show up to testify?
I'm guessing that was it, or she didn't want to get in trouble for prostitution herself. And he just kept getting caught over and over again, and he kept getting charged in court for prostitution and rape charges. One woman told police that Lorenzo, quote, threatened to kill me and bury me in the lime, which is basically the entire ground.
Yeah, I know. I totally think this is him.
While searching his trailer, too, police found sex tapes that are pretty terrifying. Okay, so anybody out there, pause. Can we pause this for a second? I want you to pause this and go to YouTube and look up Lorenzo Montoya sex tape. It's not going to be sex. It's just going to be sounds. And I'm going to play it for you. I don't want to get in trouble. So what'd you think of the clip?
It was literally the most horrific thing I've ever heard. Even, like, I had goosebumps just from listening to the tape rip.
Yeah. So also a fun little fun fact for you guys. Jen forgot to hit record again after we listened to the tape. And then we tried to re-record this and we started at the wrong spot. So now this is the third time. It's a charm. We're going to get this done right. So anyway, the tape was pretty incriminating. So it's a pretty solid case as to why he's considered a suspect. But there's only one problem with this. Lorenzo is dead. So here's the story about how he died, which was in December of 2006. Lorenzo called an escort service to get a prostitute. Shocking, I know. So while she was on her way to Lorenzo's house, she made a pit stop to pick up her boyfriend because apparently he was okay with her prostituting. Whatever. So they drive to a trailer park that was gated, which is where Lorenzo had lived. Lorenzo tells the prostitute that she can't park on the inside. She'll have to park outside of the gate. Although her boyfriend didn't like this, but was apparently okay with her selling herself, he's like, okay, let's make a quick circle around, find this guy's trailer so I know where you're at, and then we'll park where he wants us to. So at least it's kind of like a safety net. So the prostitute gets out of the car and goes into Lorenzo's house. 10 minutes go by, 30 minutes go by. And by the time an hour went by, the boyfriend's nervous. It wouldn't take a guy that long to do the deed. So he gets out and he starts walking around looking for the trailer, but he clearly wasn't paying attention too much because he actually forgets where the trailer was at.
Wait, are you serious?
Yeah. So they actually took the time to find this trailer and then he forgets where it's at.
How do you forget it? I would have sat outside of the trailer too the entire time, even though it's still a little weird.
Yeah, get some binoculars. It's not weird. Your girlfriend's in there selling herself.
Like, yeah, I guess it's already weird.
Yeah, it's already a weird situation. So whatever. So anyway, the boyfriend sees what he thinks is a security guard. Spoiler alert, it's not. And he approaches him about the situation. The quote unquote security guard is Lorenzo posing as a security guard and tells the guy he needs to get back in his car and wait, basically because this is private property. About 10 minutes go by, and just when the boyfriend is about to call the cops, he sees Lorenzo leaving his trailer with some type of huge item wrapped in tarp that he's dragging. When Lorenzo and the boyfriend make eye contact, he drops the large object like it was nothing. The boyfriend, scared that his girlfriend is in the tarp, calls Lorenzo out about it. He's like, "Hey man, what do you got in there?" To which Lorenzo responds by pulling out a gun. Well, joke's on him because the boyfriend is also packing heat. He immediately pulls out his own gun and scared for his life, he starts shooting.
He shot
Lorenzo 6 times. Yeah. So it's kind of like an all-out war in this trailer park right now. Lorenzo was dead at the scene and the girlfriend was naked, bound by duct tape, legs wrapped in a blanket with duct tape also around her neck. She was dead. The murder charges against the boyfriend were dropped because it was ruled self-defense.
Good, it should be.
Yeah, and his girlfriend's dead, so whatever. Police looked into Lorenzo's bank records, and the day before his death, he bought a comforter at Target for $45. He also bought more blankets at Macy's for $35 and another comforter for $16. So he knew that he was going to be wrapping something up. Like, it's not just, like, magically cold in his trailer. The thing is, though, they tried to match his DNA to the crime scene, like the West Mesa crime scene and were unsuccessful. They talked to a few of his past prostitutes, and while they described him as a weirdo, they were all okay and they were alive.
I feel like it's more like those type of people that like choose which ones that, you know what I mean, they'll attack.
Pick and choose which ones you want to kill. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, just because he is a constant customer to a couple people doesn't mean that he doesn't do this.
Exactly, yeah. But apparently Lorenzo lived less than 2 miles away from the burial site. In 2006, there were reportedly tire tracks leading from his trailer to the West Mesa site. So not sketchy at all, right? So that's the main suspect number one. The second main suspect is named Joseph Blaya. He is a 63-year-old convicted rapist from Albuquerque, and he's still alive. He is a landscaper by trade. So once the West Mesa murders hit the media, Joseph's ex-wife actually called the tip line and said, hey, you really need to look into my ex-husband. And he actually had a nickname called the mid-school molester. And that was like one reason that she wanted the police to look into him.
So wait, she still was with him, even though that was like a name that he had?
Apparently she was, but she wised up and she got a divorce.
I was about to say, like, even if it was like the third date, fourth date, you know, like, no, not even that. Like, even if I was engaged to someone and they're like, by the way,
on your honeymoon night, I'd be like, ugh.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I would be like, bye, Felicia. So let's jump back to 1988, where Joseph was stalking his mid-school molesting prey. A 13-year-old was walking home from school when suddenly a guy in a ski mask jumped out of the bushes. The guy rapes the innocent 13-year-old and then runs off. A rape test was performed, but I mean, back in that time, DNA technology was just not good. So right. They weren't able to connect anything. So police had actually run across Joseph more than 130 times between 1990 and 2009. Many of those encounters were across the East Central Corridor, known for prostitution and drugs. So just a hot mess of a situation. So if that doesn't prove that he was a piece of shit, he was just a violent guy who had many prostitution charges, but he didn't always pick up the prostitutes. Like a lot of the times he would just like cruise and watch them. Like a creep.
Gross.
Yeah. Like, so it's even more creepy. So his ex-wife that did report him said that he would come home with women's clothing, dress up in it, and make her have sex with him in them. She said he especially liked wearing women's underwear. So finally in 2008, he gets arrested on a domestic violence call. And part of the arrest, he was required by Katie's law to submit DNA. Have you heard what Katie's law is?
Actually, I haven't.
Okay, so this law was actually named after Katie Sepich. She was a NMSU student who was raped and murdered in 2003. She was raped, strangled, and her body was set on fire and abandoned at an old dump site. She was 22 years old, and her killer was caught in 2006. But if this law had already been in place, he could have been identified much sooner because of a prior burglary arrest. So basically, when you have a federal charge now, you have to submit your DNA.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. And this is used in 28 different states now. But the domestic violence charges were eventually dropped from Joseph. I don't know why. I don't know if his ex-wife just didn't want to get involved in it or what. But 5 years later, in 2013, as DNA technology advances, Joseph's DNA got matched with a dead prostitute discovered back in 1985. He also got connected to the 13-year-old girl he had raped from that test kit. So they're like, okay, he can't deny any of the rape charges, but he can deny killing the prostitute because, you know, this was her living. This is what she did. There's a lot of guys' DNA on her. That doesn't mean that he killed her. So he's trying to appeal this case, saying that his rights were violated. Because when they collected his DNA for the domestic dispute in 2008, they weren't supposed to keep his DNA, but they did. So technically, his DNA should have been disposed of.
Right.
Does that, Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. So they shouldn't have even had the DNA to match him to any of these crimes. He never said he didn't commit the crimes. He said it was just, you know, like I said, held longer. And he was trying to say like his Fifth Amendment was violated. But it doesn't matter because in 2015, he got charged guilty and he is currently serving a 90-year sentence for all the sexual assaults. He was charged with first-degree sexual penetration and first-degree kidnapping for 4 separate victims. He was 56 years old at the time, and so now in 2021, he's 62 years old. The judge said, quote, a defendant has no constitutionality, protected privacy interest in DNA he or she leaves at a past or future crime scene, and a defendant has no constitutional protected interest in DNA used for identification at booking upon arrest. So basically, he's saying you're full of shit. You did these crimes. You're going to jail. Apparently, though, to this day, he keeps filing appeal after appeal, but I don't think any judge will ever buy his bullshit, and most likely he will stay in prison for life.
Good. I hope not. That's literally ridiculous.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
And I understand things aren't exactly legal, you know, but I feel like there is that gray area, too, where it's like, you did do it. I mean,
yeah, you did it.
Your crime.
Like, who cares if he got his DNA held? He killed somebody, or right. Didn't quote-unquote kill, but he raped somebody. So, obviously from his past, it seems like he's a pretty solid suspect. And there were 2 other factors as to why they focused on him. 1, they searched Joseph's house and found women's jewelry, and the jewelry was not his wife's, but you know, that could be anything. But 2, detectives discovered a tree tag next to the body of one of the victims, Virginia. And if you don't know what a tree tag is, I had to look it up myself. But it's basically like a collar for an animal, except it's for a tree.
No way.
Yeah. So it's kind of cute. I think I kind of want to get a tree tag for all my trees. But basically it says like the type of tree, who it belongs to. So this tree tag was for a spearmint juniper. And they traced that tree tag to a nursery in California that sends plants to Albuquerque, and to Blaya's business records indicated that he bought plants from that nursery. So basically, his business bought plants from this nursery, and this tree tag was found next to the victim. Okay. So they're like, okay, well, that's a little bit too close to home, but you can't make anything off of that, you right. know? But that's it for like the suspects. Like, that's all they have. My personal opinion is that serial killers just don't stop killing. We talked about the Grim Sleeper, aka Lonnie Franklin, in episode 3, and he supposedly stopped killing for 10 years until he started again. But I mean, honestly, I don't buy it. I just think Lonnie like was killing and he was just never caught. He was just killing more prostitutes.
Right.
So let's do a little summary of the 5 victims we just went over. Scott Lee Kimball, he was arrested in 2006, almost a year after the final body was buried. Lou Reynolds, the pimp, who died in 2009 of natural causes. Robert Howard Bruce, he was sentenced in 2013. Lorenzo Montoya, he died in 2006 in December in a shootout. And Joseph Blaya, who was arrested in 2013. Out of those 5 suspects, who do you think is the main one?
Second one.
The Lorenzo Montoya? Yeah,
for yeah. sure. I mean, if I had to bet money on it, he's who I would bet on.
Yeah. I mean, he literally got caught in the act of killing somebody.
And it matched all of the other victims. You know what I mean? And he lived so close to the site. Like, to me, that's the one.
Tire tracks, everything like that.
Yeah. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah. So, and also the sex tape. Let's not forget that.
I will never forget that.
Let's not forget why we had to re-record this. So, regardless, though, there are no other suspects that the police are naming, at least. And to me, it seems like a cold case, but police deny this. And they say that they still get thousands of tips coming into them to this day. They are quoted saying, this case will not be shelved or classified as a cold case. It will remain open until a prosecutable case can be presented to the district attorney's office. A reward of up to $100,000 is being offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for this crime. They believe the key to solving the crime lies within that like sketchy strip that I had mentioned before of where the victims were often seen.
Right.
So they're also quoted saying, investigators would like to hear from women who may have been working the streets of Albuquerque between 2001 and 2005, or anyone who may have solicited the victims during that time. So they don't even care like if you were prostituting or not, if you were picking up prostitutes. They want to solve this cold case.
I understand.
What they call not a cold case, but.
Yeah, but I understand why people wouldn't want to come forward.
Oh, I totally understand. Because like, what if they're like, oh yeah, we don't care that you were prostituting or picking up prostitutes. But then they're like, well, we're going to get you for this drug charge, or we're going to test you or something like that. You know, I don't know. It's just a little sketchy. But they're still supposedly looking. They got a tip recently in 2020 that dirt looked a little bit different from the construction site, because they are still building houses out there. So
the place buy a house out there.
That's the last place I'd want to buy a house right now or build. But police went to go check it out and they didn't find anything. But basically there's a dialect between the contractors going on. And they're saying, hey, if you're digging or building something and you see anything that even looks weird or even might look weird, you need to call us as soon as possible. And to me, like, I understand, like, being a construction worker, like, is a great job, but I would feel like I don't get paid enough for this, like, to look for dead bodies.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's the end, though. That is the story of the West Mesa murders.
That's insane. Really good. Even the third time around. Still amazing.
Third time around. It just gets better every single time you listen to it. I think you were purposely not recording so you could just hear me talk over and over.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what happened. No, that one was amazing. I really hope they do find something to connect it, but yeah.
I think it was
learned, though. That's the hard thing about cold cases. I'm just hoping there's something with our technology that eventually will help us get to that point.
Yeah. I think that it was Lorenzo, and hopefully like they have some part of his DNA stored somewhere.
Yeah, I agree.
And they can connect him somehow. So, yeah. But that is that. So thanks for being patient with us, everyone. We kind of fail at technology if you haven't been able to figure that out by now, but we will be back next weekish with a new episode. You can find us on Instagram. The handle is Colts Killers and Cocktails. And anything else, Jen?
No, I think that's it. Please feel free to send us a DM. I think that's what they're still calling it. Or a private message on Instagram. If you guys have any comments, see something cool on TikTok you want to share, just anything.
Yep. We'll talk back. We're nice.
Bye.
All right. Thanks. Bye.